This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. Daniel Pravda is here from Norfolk, and he's going to prove it by reading a poem.
This one's called Fort Story Shoreline Fenced Off for Homeland Insecurity. And it starts off with an epigraph by George Carlin. I love America. I love the freedoms we used to have. On the northeast ear of Virginia Beach, two lighthouses pierce the fog of dawn. One black and white striped, the other brown brick with a green copper top. When did the taxpayers bestow barbed wire on themselves? At 8 a.m. sharp, the star-spangled banner gets mangled by crashing waves and running break. The sands end at the Red House on the Rocks. Granite jetty Cape Henry holding like a fist, blooming at every tide, singing like an honest siren. When the ocean routs your fence and drags that barbed wire out to sea, I will walk past and share again a laugh with the lighthouses.
Daniel Pravda is a nature poet who's an activist. And when you can be an activist about nature, that's as good as it gets. We're so happy to have you from Norfolk, Virginia. And how do you describe yourself as a poet? I mean, if someone says, well, what do you write? What do you say?
I would say I'm mostly a nature poet. I love to drive my car out from Norfolk and go into the country of Virginia and North Carolina and basically get lost on purpose. And then I'm looking at beautiful farms and woods, and I love birds like wild turkeys, and they just make me pull over to the side of the road and take pictures and write. And then I drive home and try to reorganize.
Well, you know, you're like the romantic poets who used to walk throughout England. Coleridge had actually no soles left in his shoes from looking through nature. So that's a beautiful tradition that you're going to make. And then with that, you couple your progressive ideas and your social activism, and we get a book like Normal, They Napalm, The Cotton Fields. What is in this book?
It's mostly nature poems, but not just. I'm also a musician and a photographer. And so even though I'm kind of an outsider to the farmlands that I love to drive around, I still kind of feel at one through multiple genres, and I want to preserve farmlands and natural spaces.
Do you think there are a lot of people like you?
To be honest, I feel like for the first time since you were just saying Coleridge, Wordsworth, it feels like nature poetry is not as in, or not as, I don't know, trendy in the poetry world anymore.
But because it is so perishable, I think that makes it very trendy.
And important.
So Daniel Pravda is going to read us two poems so we know who he is.
Okay.
And this is from the book, Normal, They Napalm, The Cotton Fields, that came out during COVID.
Just before, but absolutely right. This one's called Blue Crabber. And again, I'm living in Virginia Beach. We have the Lynn Haven River and the Chesapeake Bay. Since I was a child, I've seen lots of professional fishermen, anglers do their thing, and I have a lot of respect for them. That's a hard, hard working job right there. So this one's called Blue Crabber. Aboard his boat, bleached wood gray by the sun, he squints white-burned eyelashes toward the last crab pot. The slate sky and white caps calm him. The trawler free to cradle from channel to channel, buoy to buoy. The motor bellowing a cold smoke in neutral. He lifts a marker with his back and stringy arms, pulls until the chicken wire cage drags the rail and floor shellacked with patches and river water. He shakes the trap over wood and duct tape baskets, throws the bare bone over the side, and reaches for the bucket of drumsticks. Rain begins to fall from the north. He rubs a new cut and neighboring scars with salt water and listens to the hum of drops on wood and crabs bubbing, popping bubbles of suffocation. Bait in place, gash rails and rope lower the steel back into the river until the painted bleach bottle drifts over waves. The stern edges around the marker, turns away from where the channel fades into the Chesapeake. Bushels full, rain streams as the ship rocks toward the row of pier trucks. Silent seagulls struggle around the ragged flag flailing at a changeless half-mast. The crabber steers west with the most worn wheel peg.
You know, I called you a noticer because drops on the wood, it takes a man who is willing to be still a long time
yes.
to see what you see. And we don't do that anymore. I mean, we are racing with the clock,
yes.
and the clock is winning, actually. And you still have carved out a way of life that is to your benefaction. How did you manage to do that?
Since I was a kid, I've always loved nature, the outdoors. You know, I grew up on some of the boats in the river and walking in the woods. So it's, you know, again, ingrained in me since I was little. And now it's, again, growing up in Virginia Beach, I saw a lot of development. But it's not good development. It's bad development. Homes do not improve the land. So I watched Virginia Beach go from kind of a farm town with, you know, a tourist center at the beach to a giant sprawling suburbia, which is what it is now. And that kind of bothers me, to be honest with you, and angers me. So, you know, preserving, again, natural lands and farm spaces is a purpose which comes with passion.
The cementing of America, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And what do you think is going to happen?
I can't say I have a very good rosy picture of the future here. It seems like artists especially, because lawmakers aren't going to do it, artists have to work to preserve beauty and nature because we're all that's going to really do it.
I like that. I like that. And so give us another poem because you are making permanent the need, the loss, and the grandeur.
Okay. I'm going to read one called Listening to the Land. This is a poem kind of historical. You learn a lot on the road. I will definitely pull over and read historical markers and anything else and talk to people, and I learned so much, and this is one of those experiences. Listening to the land. Today, the Subaru time machine climbs the hills of Petersburg, stopping for photos of bygone barns and part-buried tractors, their plows and blades splayed like seeds of weeds. Over there, the Flower Dew 100 and the first windmill of North America. Over there, the beefsteak raid, when Confederates paid for 2,000 cattle with the lives of 14 men. Autumn orange soybeans await the reaper. Roots reach deeper for clean water as the salt sea rises from underneath. I let vultures teach me about what was and what will be pulled from bones, marrow of hidden history. Locals burned the Petersburg courthouse on purpose to hide the heritage of a few wives from New Orleans. When I sneak across ditches for shots of ruins under giant trees, I hear voices in the leaves, smell blood and gasoline coming up like truth from luscious cotton fields. Soon, newer machines will capture growing snow and beans rattling in the breeze. I keep going down roads reverting to stone and dirt. To this day, every September, the county auctions the fallen of the raid with a steak dinner.
Oh, Daniel.
Thank you.
I always say that we write the same story over and over. So your story is preserving nature. Is it ecology?
Yes.
Made lyrical.
Absolutely, and beautiful and purposeful. You know, you got to kind of motivate people to preserve things. If they can't see the beauty and the reason, then you have to kind of push it on.
Do you think that there are enough people waking up? Never mind. We'll just go right on.
Yeah.
We will just go right on with another poem.
Too many tech heads and too many cell phones.
But you yourself need all that.
Sure. I admit I'm part of the problem too.
We are. We are guilty as charged.
Yes.
But one thing we're doing is preserving the soul. If ever the poet were the conscience of the nation, Shelley said that, or Keats, but who, or Wallace Stevens, or one of those.
Oh, yeah.
Then you are surely that.
Unacknowledged legislator.
That's sure. Right. Read us a poem.
I'd like to change gears a little bit here and read a music poem. This one's called Sonic Alchemy. I love the concept of alchemy, but I never necessarily apply it to lead and gold. It's just turning something not as good into something good. And so let me see. I have a very good friend. My best friend, his name is Cove. And he and I have jammed music for many years. He's a great influence on me, musically speaking. He's also a kind of a guy who can work on his instruments as well. And this is a kind of a poem about him fixing my guitar. Sonic Alchemy. Cove the Guitar Builder installs two new humbucker pickups into my Gibson SG. The soldering gun waits for a shot of vodka. He lays out the array of wrenches, screwdrivers, and pliers by size. Tells me he's got a date with Mindy later, but she doesn't believe in vaccines. Strings clipped, pick guard flipped, dust rises like expectation. When's the last time you had her checked? Never. Not once since I got her in 05. Alcohol and rag, he rubs the fretboard like brushing a horse. I can't seem to care about the looks of perfect tones. Cove burns himself, blows metal bubbles onto strings and grounds. Sometimes I marvel at how people learn. Reassembled, shiny, clean, the pickups like mirrors, the guitar a museum sculpture. After toast, shot, and new set of strings, we plug in crank amps and the fuzz face. Glorious distortion and reverb lift us, gift us musical immunity. We jam tunes from 20 years ago and a new riff or two, punk rock speed down to blues. Soon I am drunk and deaf and welded and right. Thanks, man, I yell. Good luck tonight. He nods and fills his flask with songs.
You know, it's a perfect example of how men communicate. It is, yes. You're saying so much to each other about comradeship and trust and loyalty.
Yes.
With the frets and polishing the guitar. It never stops to fascinate me how men talk that way. I have watched your YouTube music, and it is it's really good.
Thank you.
Talk about your career in music right now.
I love music as well, even though I definitely would say poetry was my first love in terms of writing. But I always listen to music. You know, when you're a kid, you just kind of are exposed to the radio and lots of other things. And so this might be unholy, but I think I might have listened to more music in my life than I have read poetry. Just because it's more, you know, mainstream and more around.
What did you listen to growing up?
I started off with kind of the crunchy rock like Led Zeppelin and AC/DC, and that took me into Pink Floyd, and then reggae music. I love Bob Marley, blues music like Muddy Waters. I'm very eclectic.
Yes, you are.
But I still love my rock, and that's really what the band plays.
Santayana is playing in the New Orleans Jazz Festival. They're in their 80s.
That's awesome.
I know.
I saw Ravi Shankar when he was around 88, 89, perform with his daughter, and he was still just there, incredible. I was so fortunate he passed away about a year or so later.
And Taj Mahal, which used to be my signature music on this program, I used to follow him around the country. I was loved, and he is performing this week in New Orleans, and he has to be 89, I mean, 87. And yet he can. So let us...
Music or art keeps us young.
Let us champion the artist, yes. And let's have another poem.
Okay. Newer poem, Ode on Sand. So like I said, again, I walk a lot of beaches as well. Again, I live in Norfolk and Virginia Beach is right next door. So I spend a lot of time walking on beaches as well. The ocean is in just another absolute fascination. So this is one of those poems. It's called Ode on Sand. Little Keats in here. The fog fades over the bay on New Year's Day. Pale blue surface drinking light. Flat and glassy with a few ducks bobbing. I walk from the Lesnar Bridge to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. Crisp as the calendar, wispy clouds. They've wrapped the giant supports in bolted metal and weatherproof paint, but there's no such thing as permanence. Ask the poles with no pier. Ask the dunes. Ask proud fool sailors about trusting the sea. The answer is laughter. The answer is existence as long as Keats allows, and we believe in the concept known as the 2nd of January. One bridge of minutes to the Virginia Beach oceanfront. One arc of years to the eastern shore. One toll, one free. Another brand old walk with the wave.
Were you the only child?
I have a brother, and he's also a fantastic artist. He's a visual artist, great painter, photographer. That's his, he can, I can't even believe how well he can draw, and I can't draw at all.
But I'm trying to find out what formed you. I mean, loneliness is really the sound of music. Yes. So the kids who are lonely gets it into music. So I thought, and here you are a wanderer in the woods. Is it just your DNA, do you think? That is just, you were born to be Walt Whitman-esque or...
Far too kind.
Or the born to be an artist. Do you think that you're just wired that way?
I feel like it's a purpose, but I'm not sure I was wired this way. I can't say that for a fact. I was programmed.
Your parents were allowing.
Absolutely. So where I grew up in Virginia Beach was kind of across the street from an old horse farm. And there used to be this big forest that we called the Dirty Woods. And that was because there was this long kind of ruddy trail where people drove their trucks, but they dumped off, you wouldn't believe, file cabinets and washers and dryers and cars and just junk. But as a kid, it was fascinating. And then when you walked to the edge of it was the river. There was oyster shells everywhere because they would have oyster parties back there. And it formulated my childhood. And then the Dirty Woods became developed and I got angry.
Well, I forget if you have a poem called Dirty Woods.
I don't. I should.
You will.
I will.
And to prove it, you're going to read another poem.
Okay.
Daniel Pravda is the author of Normal, They Napalm the Cotton Fields, which is available on Amazon. And if you want to get a social conscience, lyrically put, then I would get this.
I'm not sure if this is the time and place to say this, but I'm publishing under Perlman. I'm not sure this is a big deal at all.
I wondered why...
Pravda is kind of my family name from Europe. It was my father's father's name. He changed it to avoid the draft in World War I to Perlman, and that's why I am named Perlman. But both my brother and I use Pravda as kind of a pen name or something, or stage name.
Well, we will remember you.
You can find me under both.
Pravda or Perlman.
That's
I believe
right.
Perlman is the name on the book.
Correct.
We'll go there.
Correct. Farm use pickup. Piles of dirt on the back bumper, as if the beginning of a burial. Long driveway to summer ditch of lazy Susan's and Queen Anne's lace. The cocky corn thinks soon it will be taller than the power line. June believes in immortality. July knows fireworks from a lie. Snowflake clouds spin and begin to understand. A yellow leaf says, carpe diem, to the mantis with no desire to pray. The farmer parks his truck next to the one that can't say no to the weeds anymore. Sparrows nest in the dashboard. Honeysuckle vines intertwine the steering wheel in the rear view. A few blades of hay blow from the open tailgate.
The cars can't say no to the weeds anymore. That would be another way of saying it's rusting in the fields.
Exactly. I love abandonment. I just adore it. Abandoned trucks, abandoned tractors, abandoned houses and barns. I love to walk them and
tell their story.
Explore them. I love to go in a silo and look up and take photos of the honeycomb of the inside of a silo.
I would call you a fulfilled person.
I try. That's it, and this is definitely what fulfills me. You are absolutely right. Music and photography and poetry give me plenty. I will never, ever be worried about retiring.
Where do you perform your music?
Really anywhere that will have us. The fact of the matter is we're not performing as much right now because we've had a few, I don't want to say issues, but, you know, again, the band is...
But that's such a rock star thing to say.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, we play when we are asked, that's for sure.
Rock stars always have issues.
Okay.
So you qualify.
Thank you. Thank
but
you.
You're first and foremost a poet. And I just want to know about your teaching, because that surely must take up a percentage of your life.
Of course. And I love teaching. Teaching is another fantastic purpose. What you're doing is seeing the kids who believe in the future.
And you have such good energy.
Thank you.
It's a perfect profession for you. Do you think the people in your undergraduate courses are different from you and when you were an undergraduate?
Yes, I do. I was a really shallow and dumb undergraduate and only really wanted to party and have fun. And I'm very proud to point out that Marilyn George Mason taught me very well in the poetry world and helped me grow up, to be honest with you. So the students today, they are very much tech-based, of course, what you might imagine. It's, you know, again, phones are an issue in class, of course, but they're better than they used to be. Now they're quiet. They just watch their videos on their phone on silent. Anyway, they're still fantastic. Please, I'm not trying to disparage the students at all. What students show me is they believe in the potential of the future. And because they do, that helps me believe in it too.
Do they really?
I tell them that they wouldn't be in college if they didn't. Because it's 4+ years to get your degree, and then the belief that you're going to get a job or a career afterwards, and that is optimistic in itself. Even if the college students do not realize it.
Yeah, you're kind of a success trainer as well as a teacher. What is the composition of your courses? Are they creative writing or literature?
Well, right now I'm teaching mostly composition.
I'd
like to go back to teaching creative writing more, but unfortunately there's not a lot of demand for it at my university, which is Norfolk State University, great school, historically black university in Norfolk. I'm proud to teach there very much. We have great students. We have great faculty there. So that's not to disparage the
student. Can people improve? You look at me as if I'm baffled. You know,
in writing or in general?
Now that's a good question. But Composition 101 breaks my heart. I have taught it as well. And it is the most unformed clay you can imagine.
Yes.
But you do make a difference, right?
Absolutely. I enjoy English 101 at this point because, first of all, I've taught it at least 100 times. And number two, so that's number one, is I can teach it with my eyes closed. Second, we have abandoned the textbook. So now I'm just using links from the internet. I get to choose them. So I can share with them fantastic pieces of literature, poetry stories, essays,
nice.
On top of the kind of, you know, writing stuff that we're working on.
Is it a requirement?
Oh, absolutely. We're required English 101 and English 102.
Oh, so people aren't there just because they need to catch up?
For instance, if you fail 101, you have to take it again.
But everyone that's a freshman has to take 101.
Correct.
How many teachers are there?
The English department's probably 20 to 30 if you include the edit.
How many courses do you teach a week?
I'm teaching 4 courses. I taught 5 last semester.
Amen. Amen.
It's a lot, but I don't mind. Again, teaching is a great gig because the students keep you young.
And you're a great gig.
I bring the energy. I am not afraid. I am not late. I try to be a good role model. I am passionate. I tell them stories. We talk about current events and go over those. I'm trying to formulate their critical thinking skills. They need to think for themselves. It's very important, and not just through social media.
What did you learn when you were in the MFA program at George Mason? Because people diss MFA programs, but you really came out with, what was the one thing you can attribute to that time?
I love the workshop. I live to workshop. And I don't do it enough. I wish I had more students and more gigs that I could help people with poetry. But when you just go into the dig deep into words and sounds and the entire thing, I enjoy that very much. And both my undergraduate and graduate schools helped me a lot to learn about how to read. And when you learn how to read, that's helping you write.
Daniel Pravda, or Perelman, or both.
Let's have
another poem.
Okay. I'd like to do another new one.
Yeah, is this going to be a new book?
I hope so.
I'd need a publisher.
Publisher Schmubberger. But what would be the title of this book?
It's called My Glorious Inability to Catch Amber Stars.
Oh.
And those are leaves.
Oh.
So.
Do you try to catch the leaves?
In the autumn, I adore the idea of walking in the woods and leaves are blowing everywhere. And I don't try to catch them, but I let them fall into my hands. And sometimes it works, but most of the time it doesn't. And I love that.
And people are watching you do this?
Usually not. Maybe a friend or two that I'm with, but no, not normally.
Well, let's hear the poem.
Okay. This one's called April. Outside of beyond yonder, Sycamore Springs, Virginia, where they cut deeds from old tree farms, plant trailers among pines all the same height. Crows lie about the shortest route. Dirt road blocked by a metal bar. Mossy bell above cages for hounds. Metal wash tubs drowned by blooming blackberry. Sassafras waves in winter wheat breeze. Borderline of birds. Hawks on power lines exactly every so often. An American flag used as the roof patch on a barn. Crows don't like the middle finger. The lone gravestone has earned the right to rot. Aroma of clover and honeysuckle. Din of wind brings the storm everyone wants to come and entertain by cracking the sky. Bees drive tractors. Crows read dry plows and speak badly of yellow finches. 14 inches of rain end another drought of doubts of sprouts outside of ground and hungry for sun.
Listen to that. Sprouts, ground. Beautiful.
Poetry music is such fun for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
Not rhyming, because rhyming is too easy. But alliteration, assonance. Mm-hmm.
Vowels. I'm in love with vowels.
Me too.
Yeah. You're inspiring me truly, Daniel.
Thank you.
Because I need to slow down. I need to look at the drops on the wood, because what else is there really?
Exactly. Exactly.
What else is there? Now I would like you to take a poem and take it apart to teach people how to write a poem or how you do it. Like, where you were, you thought of this, and how long it stayed inside of you before you put it to pen, and then what you had to overcome while writing it, how long it took. Just take people through your process.
Okay. I'm going to read a poem called Cotton Balls. This is the title poem for Normally Napalm the Cotton Fields. And it's for my friend Keith, who is basically my most common partner in crime in terms of road trips and walk in the woods and the beaches and things. Cotton balls for Keith. It's normal they napalm the cotton fields. Call it exfoliate. Burns off the leaves so the popping cotton comes out clean. Soybean sunset. Sorghum orange. Autumn hovers like the fear of Halloween. Napalm fragrance of piss and gasoline. Crop dusters like Apocalypse Now helicopters. More like horseflies. Pretty damn quiet at the close of the day, the dusk of the year. The empty road between the fields feels no need to boast. Cotton is a lovely crop, snowy, foamy, a field of Q-tips. Best case scenario for an unlucky paratrooper. Contrast with crimson barns and rusty trees. Viney silos and giant blue balers dragging, trudging, rumbling, leaving off-white houses of plastic wrap and 5-foot cotton balls blowing across the road like fog. So, that poem comes out of driving around basically northern, eastern North Carolina. And I absolutely love cotton as a crop in the fall. It's gorgeous. It just turns farms into snow. It's stunning, honestly, and it's probably my favorite crop to photograph. So one day, Keith and I were driving around, and we smelled it. So they cover the fields with this stuff, and it stinks. It's painfully, you know, obvious to the nose. It's chemically, it's gasoline, and again, it's just to make it easier for them to harvest. It's lazy. And so there's this combination, and we could talk about process again here, of beauty with anger, with disappointment, with like, why are they doing this? Is this necessary? Is this important? Of course it is important, but not the napalm. So
is this happening now?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Every season.
So you got the idea and you got the anger and you got the rage. How did you decide to enter the poem? What is the first line?
It's normal the napalm in the cotton fields.
Well.
So, and but I got to give Keith a little credit here. Keith lives out there and he knows kind of the farmlands and customs better than I do. So he was the one who told me that it's basically the same thing as napalm, literally, from, you know, Vietnam era. And they're using that. Now, they don't light it on fire, but you certainly don't want to, like, smoke a cigarette around there when they're using this stuff because, yeah, the entire field could actually go up. So it's dangerous a little bit like that. But, you know, again, I have friends that give me information, and then I can also read and learn as well. But just immersing myself out there, I will, again, pull over, write down some notes. I usually don't write full poems on the side of the road. That's really for home and then recollection. And again, I'm taking photos. Those help as well, bring back memories. So that's the process, is immerse yourself out into it. And then when you're back into, you know, civilization or home, whatever we're calling this, the ability to get quiet and let it kind of come back and overflow me.
Good advice. Good advice. Yeah. So you have a new book. Do you feel that you are showing more pictures like this? Is your new book further and deeper and broader and into nature and rage?
Yeah, absolutely. That's all I know, to be honest with you, at the moment. And
what is there to hope for?
The good news is that despite all of humanity's greed, there are still pockets of beautiful nature and people who support them and care about.
Good answer. And now a final poem.
This one's called UFO in Dismal Swamp Woods. The Dismal Swamp is a great park. And when I say great, I don't necessarily mean all that hospitable. But again, another great natural space right on the border of Virginia, North Carolina. And it's got a wonderful history in that it has kind of Native American history. It has escaped slave history. And it's, again, almost undeveloped because it's really inhospitable. Slave-dug trenches and tunnels, roads are still there. But it's still an empty place, at least aside from the nature and like the snakes and the bird and the flies and things like that. UFO in Dismal Swamp Woods. Along the state line, a dirt road dissects tobacco farms. Keith and I squeeze between fence posts, walk past opaque puddles, fallen feathers, and a torn deer blind. Safe in the trees, we trek around crushed car parts and pieces of railroad track leading to nowhere. Deeper and darker, quiet, crunching steps. Stark Cardinal chirps a warning. Crossing the border into the refuge, a metal curve peeks through pines. On slow approach, the capsule climbs to 20 feet by 10 wide. Faded but not rusted, a corrugated cylinder with a cone top leans against a tree. In silent fascination, we feel the pollen-dusted surface, slide along its length, search for a door. Through thick needles and leaves, a gashed open entrance. Flashlight shining in, we see its emptiness, its abandonment, its identity. A pushed over and rolled silo, a shelter of bullet hole surrealism, an object unidentified by the forest.
The voice of Daniel Pravda, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. We want to thank the funders, Natalie Canavor, Sandy Jackson Cohen, the Sinipet Fund, and the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.